Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, Chuck Morse, your host of Chuck Morse Speaks at Blog Talk Radio. And we are awaiting the arrival of my guest, that being author R. Thompson. He's the author of the book, To the Victor Go the Myths and Monuments, the History of the First 100 Years of the War Against God and the Constitution, 1776 to 1876, and its Modern Impact. And I believe that we are now joined by Arthur Thompson. Arthur, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I'm really enjoying this book. It's very timely, and you get into essentially a history of the radical left in the United States, surprisingly going all the way back to around the time of the American Revolution. Most people assume the radical left started in the 20th century, and you show the intersection between the development of that left and Europe going back to the founding of the Illuminati, which was on May 1st, 1776. And it's a very difficult history to document and to record because it is secretive and because much of the information has been obscured and destroyed. So I'm learning a lot about history that I didn't know about by reading this book. And I want to thank you for writing it.
Well, that's fine. My pleasure, actually. It took 45 years to bring it all together. The thing that got me started was I was on my way to a meeting with four men in a car, and one of the fellows in the back seat said, "Well, my state finally paid off its war bonds." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Like, you know, why would I care?" But I said, "From Korea? Right. No. The Second World War? No." I says, "Well, what war bonds are you talking about?" And he says, "From the Civil War." And it had been 100 years. It had been 100 years since the defeat of the South. And so I said to myself, "Well, what else don't I know about this time period?" Well, it kept leading me back and back and back and back. Until I realized that there was a heavy influence into the United States by the Illuminati and its effect. Now, you cannot deny the historical fact of the Illuminati. The thing where people get into a debate is whether or not it had any influence and how much influence and whether it went out of business when many of the history books say it did, et cetera. And there is a lot of stuff out there on the internet and in books about the Illuminati that are just quite, frankly, gross exaggeration.
Yeah.
But when you really look into it seriously and comprehensively and logically and so on and so forth, their influence was profound.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the existence of the Illuminati, founded by Adam Weishaupt, who's a canon law professor at Ingolstadt University in Munich, Bavaria. That's not even controversial at all in Europe. I mean, it's well known. It's just it's part of the history of Europe. And Winston Churchill made reference to it in the 1930s. You know, it's just it's part of the firmament. What appears to be controversial is whether or not it continued after it was banned by the Bavarian police. However, the ideas of the Illuminati absolutely have continued, and there's every indication that it did continue in various forms and under various guises. It just sort of does, like, I mean, anyone who understands how the left operates today knows that they can shape-shift themselves. They could even become conservative if they need to. They can disguise that they're chameleon-like in that they, I mean, Marx talked about this in the final passage of the Communist Manifesto. He said, "You have to adapt yourself to the country where you're operating, and all for the, you know, the ultimate good of creating a one world ed college," and that this is just part of how they operate. So, you know, there's every reason to assume that they continued under different guises, and yet it's difficult to know what that is because it's secret. Because it's secret, we can speculate. You and I may not agree about specifics. Like, I happen to think that It's a fact that Weishaupt used the European masonry to, he infiltrated it, he imitated it, and he used that secret infrastructure to spread the Illuminati. I think that masonry has been completely corrupted by the Illuminati. you seem to think that it's really not. But either way, I mean, we can't know because these are secret societies by nature.
Well, they are, but the thing is too, you've got to again ask the question: what is Masonry? There's Masons and Masons, so I would agree with you on. Let me say I half agree with you in that there are certain Masons, certain Mason orders that you're absolutely correct. There are other Masonic orders that are influenced but not controlled.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. You get into a discussion of how the Illuminati, which I think it's been very confirmed by history, was the main spawn of the French Revolution, which
yes.
was a counter-revolution, really. I mean, we should recall that King Louis XVI, who was an ally of the United States and who was seen as a great man in the United States, we have cities named after him, including Louisville, Kentucky, he basically agreed to hold the Estates General. And by doing so, he effected the French Revolution without firing a shot. He said, "I'll continue as a constitutional monarch," and he started the process of National writing up a new constitution, which was influenced by Benjamin Franklin. I mean, and also Thomas Jefferson and some of the great Americans were in Paris in those years, John Adams and many others, and they. You know, but what happened is that in the ensuing years, the thing was co-opted by secret societies, and eventually it was overthrown. He was beheaded. The Constitution was rewritten, and the Jacobins launched the Reign of Terror, which is the world's first communist revolution. And that was completely contrary to what the French people expected. They wanted to have a more American-like system. They admired the United States. They didn't necessarily want to get rid of their king, but they wanted to do. They wanted to move in the direction of individual freedom.
Would
that
history
be accurate on that? Yep.
The thing is that what a lot of people don't understand well enough is that a society will actually form its own government and maintain its own government. If you change that society, it will effectively change the government no matter what you do. Now, if you do not change that society and you have a communist revolution, then what happens is that society possibly could come back with a counter-revolution and throw the rascals out, maybe even execute them. If you read Karl Marx, particularly the Communist Manifesto, they always referred to as what they wanted as social revolution. In other words, change society. And in the structure of in the process of changing that structure of society, it will affect the government that they want. That's what's happening in our country. They are systematically changing our society until ultimate through a number of different things. The one that immigration is one of them. I've never known anywhere in history where mass immigration or migration has not changed the country into which that migration went. But the thing that there are basically four catalysts for changing society. Number one, and the best one, is war. The second one is terrorism. The third is economic collapse. And the fourth is migration. Now, war has to take place on the soil of that country. Everybody will do what they have to do to win a war. In other words, the citizens themselves will tax themselves, put chains on themselves and everything else in the name of winning the war. For instance, in World War II, prior to that, you didn't have any tax on cigarettes. Then suddenly they said, okay, in the name of the war, we're going to have a cigarette tax. Well, when the war was over, they didn't take that tax away. They kept the tax. Now, that's neither a good or a bad thing. It's just an example. And so what happens in time of war is that they will do these things, and it never goes to the way it was before the war. Even if they have the best intentions, they will always maintain a certain amount of that government control, that government taxation and regulation and everything else. So in order to change, they tried to change the United States at first with the Jacobin Revolution within our country right after right after the ratification of the Constitution. But it didn't work, and they realized they were going to have to change the American society to make it work. And they brought about the Civil War, specifically for that mm-hmm. purpose. And they didn't. In fact, if you take a look at the 10 steps for communizing a country that was outlined by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, the right. United States government went 50% to 100% toward every one of those 10 steps as a result of the war. They've never looked back. There were some things that eased off, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, look, you make the point that, in a sense, the what we euphemistically call the Eastern Seaboard liberal establishment, that they are, rather than outright implementing authoritarian dictatorship and turning the United States immediately into a province of a one world order, they do it by what the communist Antonio Gramsci called the Great March through the culture. They do it by gradually, incrementally, step by step, taking over the financial system, the business system, the cultural system, the colleges, certainly the academic world, the performing arts, the media. You know, all of our institutions of education, of learning, of transmittal of information, and they do
even
it
religion.
Gradually over time. Oh, absolutely, especially. They will co-opt, organizations. They have a very interesting means of doing it. It's something that, I mean, I've actually written about this in one of my books. And, it's something that we need to learn about and understand. But, you know, we were talking about how in modern times this was established by the Illuminati. Of course, it goes before that. I mean, this is an idea that Whitaker Chambers described it as the world's second oldest religion. And that he used the metaphor of the Garden of Eden. When Eve was tempted by the forbidden fruit, the serpent said, "You can be as gods. You can know all good and all evil. In other words, you can overthrow God in heaven." And that's been the communist ethos all the way back to pagan times. I mean, the Bible warns us about this when they talk about paganism. It wasn't just idol worship, worshiping a graven image. There was a lot going on around that. It was worship of the state. And that the graven image was obviously a false entity that was manipulated by the state. And they were warning us to not worship the state, but worship God, because God has immutable truths that are beyond manipulation by the state. But anyway, bringing it to modern times, you have the Illuminati, and then you have their ideas. And the key ideas of the Illuminati is the one world ant colony. And that in order to achieve it, they have to tear down institutions and ideas that represent, that help the individual advance and be a sovereign individual thinker. And those include religion, private ownership, business, the right to trade goods and services, and sovereignty. And that these things gradually have to be whittled away and eroded. And that's how they work their way, by worming their way into the system. And that's what they've been doing in this country, as you say.
Well, that's right. And at the same time, they have to, which we've just kind of tangentially talked about, they have to lower the morality level of the population. In other words, a moral people can rule itself, an immoral people cannot. They have to be ruled. And so they've been steadily eroding our morality. Now, a lot of people don't realize that morality transcends what I do as an individual. What I do as an individual, I get a lot of sermons every Sunday on that. But there aren't very many pastors that talk about civic morality. And they've divorced that whole idea out of Christendom, basically, in this country, to where there's very seldom any pastor or priest or anybody else gets up and talks about civic morality. What you need to do in your community to uphold your communities, as a good neighborhood, as a good local government, so on and so forth. That used to be imbued within the American people. In fact, that was imbued in them before we even had the War of Independence. John Adams stated that the real revolution was the education of the people before the War of Independence, that it never would have happened if the American people didn't understand their responsibility under God for a decent system of government. And that is the thing that's terribly lacking today.
Oh, absolutely. Speaking myself as a Jew, I can tell you that I look to the Torah, which has an entire code of morality and ethics. It teaches me how I am to interact with other people, personally, professionally. It teaches me how nations should interact with each other, how families should interact with each other. It establishes private property. It establishes limited government, which it did at Sinai. If you look at the passages dealing with Jethro, it establishes the rules of engagement when it comes to war. It began the process of abolishing slavery and accepting individual sovereignty under God. It established labor laws. I mean, it establishes everything is in it. And the fact is that the left has to undermine that, because rather than have an immutable code of moral and ethical structure, which we can look to and which cannot be altered, they want to alter it. They want to transform it and change it to suit their own earthly goals. In other words, they want to replace God, just like what the serpent said. They want to be able to say, you know, this is now what we think is right, because we're smarter, we're better than God, we're better than you. And that they will therefore, you know, shape-shift morality to fit the situation as it stands. You don't hear preachers today, rabbis, ministers, priests for that matter, even though I think the Catholic Church still has a lot of moral weight. You don't hear them talk about the morals and the ethics of the Bible. You know, I mean, it's all sort of situational now.
Well, that's true, but there is still a remnant, and they do teach and preach really sound biblical principles, but rarely do they teach their principles as it relates to civic government. That's a real problem. In fact, I was just reading some statistics this last week, and I hope they're not true, but I'm afraid that they are. And that is that close to 70% of those individuals who refer to themselves as Christians either don't vote or aren't registered to vote.
And, oh, my God, that's horrible.
It is an appalling situation. It was done by a Christian group. It wasn't, it was just trying to say to everybody, get out there and do what you're supposed to do.
Those who have been influenced by illuminated ideas, whether they're consciously parts of secret societies or not, is beside the point. I think most people aren't. They just, they've internalized these things. They've been brainwashed since childhood to understand that certain ideas, it's like a carrot and stick. If you agree with certain things, you get awards, you get the advancement, you get social acceptance, you get to date, and if you disagree, then you're excoriated publicly, and you could lose your advantage, and you could they make examples of people all the time. I've seen it in my own life. And, you have a situation where thus people are conforming to these ideas. Now, you say you think that Christian organizations and the church has been that illuminated figures have wormed their way into it. And I think this is an example of that. I mean, if Christians feel that they are not engaged, they don't need to engage in civic life, then that, to me, that has to be part of a conspiracy.
Absolutely. Now, they very early on started to capture the Christian publishing houses. I mean, way back, over 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And they didn't have to change the Bible. All they had to do was to change the attitude towards its reading and comprehension. And this is the thing that a lot of people don't recognize, is that if I am ingrained with the idea that I'm not really supposed to be involved in earthly matters, then that does a complete, it sears my brain, so to speak. And I don't read the scripture the way I ought to read it, whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament. And yet, from cover to cover, from Genesis to, Revelation, it says you have to oppose evil and the consequences of not doing so. It's amazing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's complete engagement in this world, and it's given when we have a blueprint from from heaven to teach us and to give us guideposts on how to engage in this world and how to measure our lives. And, you know, you talk about changing the meaning of words, changing the meaning of passages. I mean, that's absolutely a part of the illuminated agenda. It was articulated by Marx in many of his pamphlets, and it was part of this British Fabian movement in the late 19th century when the Fabians said, we're not going to be able to take over England through a Bolshevik-style revolution, so we're going to do it by, as I said, boring from within, changing the meaning of laws, changing the meaning of words, and they then, of course, transplanted that into the United States in the form of an organization called the American Civil Liberties Union. And basically what they've done is they've changed the meaning of words, literally. Like the word patriot comes to mean paying taxes. You know, the word welfare comes to mean, you know, it's really what we're talking about is private charity. It becomes government confiscation of wealth. You know, the word abortion is a euphemism for killing the unborn child. What are they aborting? You know, an airplane flight? In other words, they use euphemism, they use sophistry, and they change the meaning of words so that we become used to reading the exact same text, but we understand it differently.
Well, in the book, my book, I point out that was started by the Illuminati and perfected under Nicolai Bonneville in his Circle Social or Social Circle in Paris. They actually published a dictionary to get their minions to start changing the meaning of these words in their conversations and writing. Just to give you an example, when I was growing up, when I was a little kid, if you called a person a square guy, that meant he was four square. He was, you know, he was forthright, he was honest, he was responsible, etc. Until I got to be a young adult and you called a guy a square, he was a nerd. They had changed the word.
Right.
And they do that even.
It's taken on a derogatory meaning. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. And an original definition was completely the opposite. It was an honorable thing to be called. So yeah, they do it all the time.
Oh, absolutely. So we have the influence of this illuminated philosophy emanating out of Europe, co-opting the French Revolution. But I want to talk a little bit about how it landed on American shores. You talk about Nicholas Bonneville and his friendship with Thomas Paine and how Paine became corrupted in this after he had written Common Sense, which was, I think, a great document. But this is later.
Yes.
And you talk about Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin as possibly being a part of this. I think it's safe to say that they were definitely men of the left, but would you say that they were like conscious, witting participants in the illuminated conspiracy?
Well, I look upon Jefferson as a man who had three lives. And when he was in Paris, as you well know, he got immersed in some pretty immoral things. And that had its effect on him. But the thing was that Jefferson kind of wallowed in this for a while. Once he became president, he came out of it to where he was almost like a Federalist. But that immorality level of his that he had for a time affected his political thinking. And it was the same with Franklin. I don't think Franklin, when he was in Europe, he was very much involved in the occult, in extracurricular sex and everything else. He was very much involved with the Rosicrucians, and he belonged to illuminated lodges. And by that, I don't mean that they were just superficially illuminated. They were controlled by the Illuminati, and he was, even his ghostwriter, Marabou, was a key member of the Illuminati. But I think that Franklin didn't really want to have that style revolution in the United States. When he came home, he kind of left a lot of that over there. But at the same time, he was still a libertine, and he started to help illuminate some of the social mores rather than the actual form of government itself.
You make the right case that Jefferson and Franklin, at least at different stages in their lives, were libertine, and they were, you know, they certainly were not that they contradicted conventional notions of morality, but I mean, were they like winning conscious members of the Illuminati? Were they actually like wanting to conspire to turn the United States into a province of a world government and end all religion?
Well, that's difficult to say. Now, as far as we know from just superficial look at documentation, tells us that Jefferson was not a Christian, was actually an anti-Christian.
Right.
But as far as
mm-hmm.
answering your question goes, one of the biggest problems that we have is the destruction of documentation. Some of the things
right.
we know were destroyed. One of those things, and I wish I had the time and particularly the money, to go to Germany and see if the records that the Gestapo confiscated when they occupied Paris between the social circle and the Humanad Lodge and a number of those things that these men were involved in were all confiscated by the Gestapo and taken back into Germany. Now, did they destroy those documents or did they keep them? I don't know. It would be nice to find out, but I just have never had the time or the money to go to do those kinds of searches. As we know, the Germans kept meticulous records. And so I would imagine that somewhere along the line, somebody got these things because somebody gave them the order to confiscate it. Now, it would be interesting to know who gave them the order to do that and what happened to these documents afterwards, because there's a straight line from the Illuminati into Nazism. And
sure.
there are a lot of things that they did not want people to know. All the racial problems and everything else, the tremendous hatred for the inferior races, so to speak, by the Nazi leadership is traceable to Göttingen University, where Adam Weishaupt found his final refuge, and the other Illuminati professors that were there were tremendous racists. And so I think they wanted to make sure that the record would not be known for the people to ferret it out. And, one of the real good books on this that's pretty, I think it's still readily available, is Fire in the Minds of Men by Billington.
Oh, yeah, by James H. Billington, yeah, who was
yeah.
the Librarian of Congress. He was appointed by Reagan. It is an excellent study of secret societies from the Illuminati to the Russian Revolution. Absolutely
yeah.
brilliant book.
But it's confined itself
your,
pretty much to the United States. I mean, to Europe, rather.
To Europe, exactly.
Yeah.
You point out that it's very difficult to do this kind of research because it destroyed so many documents. It's so true. I interviewed a woman, I forget her name right now. She wrote a fantastic book about the secret Soviet influence on the United States during World War II, and how the people inside the government who were pro-Nazi, pro-Soviet, like Hiss and others, how they manipulated Roosevelt. And part of her research was to go back and take a look at some of the research done by Senator Joseph McCarthy. And what she discovered was that much of the information about McCarthy, including the article in Wheeling, West Virginia, that carried the story of when he first broke his research on communists inside government, that it was all gone. It had been all confiscated in the library. You couldn't get it. And there were other areas of important research. His list of communists, all this information is gone. It's been, somebody's co-opted it. It's been wiped out. And
well,
so
I found
that tells me that, yeah.
I was going to say, I found that true of anything in libraries that documented subversive secret society communist influence in the United States before 1900. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I went to Houston, and I went to into the Texas room there, which is the old library, and they archive all this Texas research. And they had a file in there, and you go in, and they reserve the right to search you and your persons before you leave. You can't use a pen or a pencil. They issue you, or at least when I was in there, they issued you a short stub of a very soft leaded pencil to use, in case that you might brush it up against something and they wanted to be able to take it off easily. And and that kind of thing. You couldn't go and to the shelves. You had to ask a library assistant to bring you something and then give it back before you get something else. Anyway, I got three things out of the file, and I wrote them down on slips of paper. That was the maximum you could ask for. And I handed it to this librarian, and I said, could you pull these for me? I says, these two you'll have. This third one, I doubt you'll have it. And she said, well, was it in the file? I said, yes, it was in the file. She says, well, we'll have it then. I said, well, I'll be pleasantly surprised. 45 minutes later, she came back and says, how did you know that this was gone? And I said, because this had been disappearing systematically, concertedly, all over the country in various libraries, even from the archives, where they have some amount of security. But in the interim, she said, you know, you might be interested in this other paper that we've got in the file that's not in, in our files, but not in the file. And she says it was about the members of the Texas Rangers that belonged to the Knights of the Golden Circle. And it was very revealing, the stuff that she brought me. But these sorts of things happen from library to library to library. I've gone into libraries where I've gone into the computers, for instance, and the books will come up stolen. And that kind of thing. There's been a systematic purging of the libraries of this kind of information, just as this woman's example with the McCarthy research.
Right, and you know, it's, I mean, it goes all the way up. I mean, more recently, I was in Washington, D.C. I was with my wife, who was attending a conference, and I decided to go to the National Archives to do a little research on for a book I was writing at the time. I ended up not writing this book, but it had to do with communists in the Roosevelt administration. And what I discovered, and you know, you go in there, you have to put on gloves, and it's all very antiseptic, as you just described. And the information that I wanted, what I discovered is that it's all still classified. Now, there's no reason for that stuff to be classified. You know, all of the principals are long dead. This is just to protect reputations. It's to protect a bigger picture. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's still information in this country and in our archives that's classified going back to the War of 1812. I mean, there's an enormous amount of secret documents, and those are only the ones that exist. As you say, I mean, the stuff's been, you know, been purged. I mean, people go out. I mean, a kind of a more recent example, I suppose, during World War II was when a folk band that eventually became known as the Weavers recorded an album in 1940 attacking Roosevelt as a, you know, as a bourgeois capitalist, and because at that time they were supporting Hitler. You know,
yep.
This is before the Operation Barbarossa, and their policy was to support both Hitler and Stalin, and they were suddenly quote unquote peace people. You know, they wanted to keep America out of the war. And about 2 weeks after that album was released, Hitler double-crossed Stalin. Of course, the two socialist behemoths went to war. And overnight, the new policy was that the communists in this country and their followers were to become super warlike and patriotic all of a sudden. They wanted war. And that album was completely taken off of every shelf. You cannot get that now. You cannot find out the lyrics. It was completely purged from it was completely censored. So, I mean, I bring this up only to point out that your research for your book To the Victor Go the Myths and Monuments, that this is research that's really hard to come by. And I think you do a really good job of trying to work with a little bit of information that we have out there.
Well, it's true. But like I said, it took me 45 years. And
sometimes. No, I mean, and everything in here, I mean, as I read it, I'm like, yeah, I'd like to look into this one further and maybe write my own book about it. I mean, there's just enormous compendium of information here. And it's on a subject that's very, very difficult because we don't have the information in front of us. Getting back to the American founding, I mean, I tend to think that based on the information that we do have, that that generally speaking, we, this country, maybe it's divine providence, but our founding fathers really were patriots, including Jefferson and Franklin. At the end of the day, and even though Jefferson and Franklin might have been anti-religious, I don't think they were trying to destroy religion. And in fact, Jefferson, in his letter to the Danbury congregation, I mean, this has been completely altered and perverted by the left. The fact is, he was telling them that there should be a wall of separation between religion and faith, because he's quoting the Bible. I mean, that's right out of the Torah, that to build a hedge around belief and to create a difference between the secular government and the faith, so that the faith can be free and that people can be free to express that, and that the faith would then serve as sort of a counterbalance and a restraining influence on government power. And that's how Jefferson meant that. And of course, that's been taken by the left to mean that, you know, religion should be banned from the from the public life.
Sure. Well, yeah, in most people, they talk about the First Amendment. They never actually seem to have read it, which is shocking.
Right.
But you know, there are a lot of instances. For instance, just off the top of my head, where I know that documents existed but were destroyed. All of Payne's records were destroyed. All of Aaron Burr's records were destroyed on their deaths by their secretaries. All the records from the Confederate Secret Service were burned. All the letters and correspondence that Judah Benjamin had, who was the Secretary of State and Secretary of War, and a number of offices in the Confederacy, were all destroyed. And on, you find these things that these people, for some reason, did not want anyone after their death to learn what was in those documents.
Hmm.
We even find that Benjamin Butler, for instance, had somehow, in the investigation of the Lincoln assassination, had carted off a number of documents that were found in the attic by his grandkids once he died. But it doesn't say what happened to those documents after that, even. So there are a lot of things of that nature that we wish we could have in front of us to take a look. In fact, I mentioned in my book, one of the purposes is to stimulate others from their vantage point to look into these things and find further research, story even wider as to what was going on. And the other thing is, too, that you kind of talk about it in a tangential way, but we're never quite sure when one of these conspirators is telling the truth and when he isn't. You know, they flip around. Like you used the example of the Weavers. I remember as a kid, there was a communist-controlled union on the waterfront of Seattle, and they had put up all these posters during the Korean War saying, we got to get rid of that dirty, rotten MacArthur. He's terrible, on and on and on. And Truman finally fired him, and they plastered over the MacArthur posters with the anti-Truman posters. Got to get rid of this Truman. He fired this great General MacArthur. And I thought, what hypocrites.
Good example, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after they finally most likely get rid of Donald Trump, I'm sure that they're all going to now become conservatives because it fits their agenda. Now, we're reaching toward the end of the program here. My guest is author R. Thompson, the author of To the Victor Go the Myths and Monuments. I want to bring things up, since we only have a few minutes left here, Arthur, to the election, which is only about 20, 25 days from now. I think that Donald Trump maybe inadvertently, I don't think consciously necessarily, but he has stumbled onto the existence of this internationalist, Wall Street-controlled, multinational, left-wing entity that seeks to create a world order. And he's done it in a spectacular way. He's woken people up. I don't know if he's I don't know, you know, whether or not he personally is aware of that. Who knows? But the fact is that he has done this in the same way in England that the people woke up and they got rid of the membership in the European Union. And the result is that you have an opposition to him that is fiercer than anything that I have ever seen. It's not just the liberals, of course, and the Democrats, but it's the Republican establishment that's actually doing him in, state by state. And the level of voter fraud and the complete control by the media is so open and so blatant that either I must think that they assume that they've become so powerful at this point that they can do this and get away with it openly, or they're just trying to do whatever they can to stop Trump. And it's the fierceness of it is unprecedented, I think, probably since the Civil War. What do you think is going on here?
Well, I agree with you, but how old are you?
I'm 55.
Okay, so you didn't live through the tremendous attack on the John Birch Society, which was about the same as it is with Trump. It was just constant, consistent. The thing is that there's even subtleties in this attack. I don't know if Trump knows everything or not. I don't have a clue. But even Fox News and Fox, you know, the regular Fox stations used to be a little more subtle about their attacks on Trump. But now some of them are so openly brazen about it. It's just incredible. I think when he if he loses, I don't know if he's going to win or not. There are indications that these polls and such are not accurate, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Even there's going to be voter fraud too. I mean,
It's open. I mean, in several states, they have a guy in Pennsylvania who's bragging. He's a postal worker about how many Trump ballots he's destroyed. I mean, it's to my way of thinking. I mean, it's always been there. I mean, certainly Obama used it, but this is more. It's almost like they're not doing it. They're not even pretending to be secretive about it. They're just saying, hey, we have to stop Trump no matter what. This is, you know, we're going to do whatever we take. I mean, I think Trump should watch his back.
Well, not only that, but if he loses, he's going to find that his empire is going to crumble around him. They're not going to allow his empire his business empire to stand. They will do everything they can to destroy him.
Oh, no, nobody will ever hear from him again.
Yeah.
I mean, this is it's a fight for life. But what do you think, I mean, of the phenomena of, I mean, I have never heard in my lifetime a candidate bring up things like putting America first and mean it, and national sovereignty and protecting America's borders and, you know, economic policies that protect American industry. And, you know, I mean, the stuff that he's bringing up is, that's the problem, I mean, that this establishment's having. He's really stepped on landmines.
Well, if he gets elected and just keeps two promises, it will go a long way towards preserving the United States. And one is massive immigration, and the other is these trade partnerships, and all that which revolves around the TPP and those sorts of things. You know, those were issues that the John Birch Society was involved in, 15, 20, and longer years ago, trying to get people to wake up that this is a real serious danger to the sovereignty of the United States and what that means. Most people, they don't realize what sovereignty means. I just was given some school texts when I was in Texas last week, showing me what they're teaching kids relative to just standard facts. And for instance, one of the things that the War of Independence, that made the Continental worthless. Now, it's a total, it's a real twist of what inflation really is and so on and so forth. But they can tell enough of it to say, well, we talk about it, but not enough for anybody reading it to understand it.
People have no idea what monetary issues are now. I mean, these were issues that used to be discussed in every election. And now it's, you know, and this is, I'd like to do a whole separate show on that one with you, Arthur, sometime, because it's a great issue. I mean, I happen to admire Andrew Jackson's taking on the second bank. I think maybe you and I don't totally agree on that. But either way, I mean, the history of America's money is really where everything is sort of the epicenter of where everything is buried. Where can people get your book, Arthur?
Oh, they can get it from jbs.org or shopjbs.com, and they can either get it hardbound. Softbound is, I think, $15, but they can go online and order it either jbs.org or shopjbs.com. I mean, excuse me.
All right, Arthur. Listen, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and thank you very much. We'll do it again soon.
Okay, thank you. So long. Bye.
All right, take care.